Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program.
Clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for being here. Let me tell you some of the things that I consider important today. Hagia Sophia is being declared a mosque again. Now, this is an architectural masterpiece that goes back to 360 AD when it was constructed as a Christian church. In 1453, right, we had the Ottoman Empire take over Constantinople, and they turned it into a mosque. And then in 1935, Kemal Ataturk, who Turkey is named after, started a process of secularization and turned it into a museum, where it's been. I was there 2 years ago. It's kind of weird to see what was once a great church and also a great mosque turned into a museum. President Erdogan of Turkey is turning it back into a mosque, and there are all kinds of proposals of trying to even share a church and a mosque together. We're going to talk about some of these things with Professor Ronald Suny of the University of Michigan. Also coming up today, we have got Church News Roundup with Matthew Bunsen. EWTN's Doug Keck will be with me to talk over a number of issues, including Black Lives Matter, which has been a bit of an internal conflict at EWTN. Also, we'll be talking about the Lord's Prayer with Father Jeffrey Kirby, an extended meditation on this prayer, which is, of course, the most famous prayer we have, and it's one that bears meditation upon. Every phrase of the Lord's Prayer is rich in theological meaning. It's rich in our vision of the kingdom of God. So that's going to be coming up. But first, let's get to the headlines.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, July 10th. It's the Feast of St. Veronica Giuliani. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. One of the world's most historic buildings will return to being a mosque. Turkey's High Court revoked Hagia Sophia status as a museum today. It was built as a cathedral in the 6th century and is considered the greatest example of Byzantine Christian architecture. It became a mosque during the Ottoman Empire. It was then turned into a museum in 1934. Tropical Storm Fay is forcing President Trump to postpone his rally in New Hampshire tomorrow. The president's re-election campaign says his visit to Portsmouth will be rescheduled very soon due to the bad weather. Health officials are hoping today doesn't end up the same as yesterday after the U.S. on Thursday posted a record amount of new COVID-19 cases. According to a date from Johns Hopkins University, more than 65,000 cases were reported yesterday, with a record amount for a 24-hour period. Over 133,000 people in the U.S. have died of the virus, and that includes about 1,000 in the past 24 hours. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is in favor of more coronavirus stimulus checks for Americans. He told CNBC a new relief package should be passed by Congress by the end of the month. The Trump administration is putting travel and asset sanctions on several senior officials of the Chinese Communist Party for their role in the mass internment of Uyghurs. An estimated 1 million Uyghurs, members of a Muslim ethno-religious group, have been detained in Chinese re-education camps where they're reportedly subject to forced labor, torture, and political indoctrination. The Chinese government defends these actions as appropriate measures against terrorism. Listed officials and their family members will be unable to enter the U.S. or do any business with U.S. persons. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Istanbul's Hagia Sophia was for nearly 1,000 years the largest and most important house of Christian worship in the world until it was converted into a mosque in the 15th century after the conquering of Constantinople by the Ottomans. The building has been, I think it's 1935 or so, 1934, but it was turned into a museum. Now, it's still filled with priceless Christian mosaics and frescoes. I was there just a few years ago, I think 2 years ago. And it's a very strange thing to see a house of worship, whether it's a Muslim house of worship or a Christian house of worship, turned into a museum. There's something weird about it. But we now find that President Erdogan of Turkey has decided he wants to turn it back into a mosque, and it looks like he has the sufficient legal groundwork to do it. With me right now to talk a little bit about this move, we're joined by Ronald Suny, who is Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Michigan. He was the first holder of the Alex Manoogian Chair, in Modern Armenian History, and he founded the Armenian Studies Program there. He's the author of They Can Live in the Desert, But Nowhere Else, A History of the Armenian Genocide. And he has served as chairman of the Society for Armenian Studies. Professor, good to have you with me. Thank you.
I'm happy to be here.
What do you make of this move on Erdogan's part?
It's part of a larger political moment in Turkey. Recep Tayyip Erdogan is at the moment, like Donald Trump here in America, faced by a real crisis. And the crisis is one not of his own making, that is the great pandemic. But once the COVID-19 took hold in Turkey, he, like Erdogan, like Bolsonaro in Brazil and others, failed to really deal adequately with it. In fact, encouraging in some ways the further spread of the virus. So he's caught in this moment, as is much of the globe. And secondly, the economy has been bad, and it's only gotten worse because of this virus situation. So he is faced with trying to develop some aspect of his political appeal to gather support while his own political party, the so-called AKP, is in fact dividing. And he's taken up this nationalist moment, this idea of appealing to Islamic nationalism within Turkey and turning one of the most prominent cathedrals, now a museum, Hagia Sophia, into a mosque.
And this is a popular move then, huh?
It's popular because, you know, Turkey is very divided. Turkey is almost 50-50 divided between those who are still the product of the long period of rule by Kemal Atatürk, a period of forced modernization, state control, secularization, the marginalization of Islam, all of those things, at very conservative, militaristic rule, punctuated by a bunch of coups about every 10 years. That's one part of the population that was affected and modernized and secularized. And the other, those folks who were not affected by this secularization, and maybe more than 50% of the population, that is, we're still, you know, devout Muslims, and they never quite adapted to this full modernization. So many Turks are divided. They may, in fact, have a little bit of the idea that we should be progressive and more European, and yet they also have their allegiances to their Islamic Muslim traditions.
Sure.
And Erdogan has decided to move toward the right and to appeal to the most conservative, nationalistic religious elements in the country.
He's been doing that all his career as president, hasn't he? It's been a kind of a slow move in that direction.
It's one of the saddest things that I've watched in the years that I've been going back and forth to Turkey. When they first came to power, this party of justice and development, it's called Erdogan's party, they were progressives. They were Democrats. many of us, and I would include myself, were fooled by some of the rhetoric and some of the practices. What he was doing was curtailing and limiting the power of the military and the old Kemalist elite, which had ruled since the 1920s. But then, roughly around 2011, he began to move in a different direction and become less democratic. He was, one, frightened by the student movement, so-called Gezi Park movement, which were calling for more liberal and more democratic developments, getting closer to Europe. And he also was perplexed and didn't know quite what to do with the 20% of the population in Turkey, which is not Turks, not Christian, but Kurdish, who want autonomy, self-rule rights, to learn their own language and have their own culture in eastern Turkey. And so he turned against them eventually and decided to ally with the right, with the most nationalist elements in the population. And so what we're watching today with this move in Hagia Sophia to turn it into a mosque is one more element in that move to a much more conservative, religious, nationalist position.
Sure. I have an incident here, and I just came across it in a column by Mustafa Akgul, who I know he's been on this program a few times. But he mentions that a member of parliament who recently resigned from Erdogan's Justice and Development Party and who is speculated to be a member of the Fethullah Gulen movement, Hami Yildirim, appealed to parliament last week demanding the reopening of Hagia Sophia, and some think that with this move, the Gulen movement, which is praised for its ecumenism but condemned in Turkey, is trying to restore its conservative credentials within Turkey. They were blamed during the the coup attempt 2 years ago or so. Do you know anything about this particular incident?
Actually, I don't know much about that particular instrument, but you've given a lot of detail, which characterizes the right kind of situation. That is, Erdogan was allied with this Gulenist movement. The Gulenist movement was a very powerful religious educational movement that managed to infiltrate the state, the police, the military, etc. And then when they began to expose, around 2014, 2015, that corruption had reached not the Erdogan family, Erdogan turned against the Gulenists. Then in 2016, as you just mentioned, some elements in the army said to be allied to Gulen, and by the way, Gulen lives in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. launched a coup, a kind of almost, sad to say, comic opera coup, very, very badly organized, quite spontaneous. Several hundred people were killed. And what it did was destroy the Gulenist movement and absolutely consolidate power in the hands of Erdogan. So much power that many of the original democratically oriented members of his own party, who liked what he had been doing up to roughly 2011, 2012, began to move away from him. And some of them have left and formed their own party. So Turkey is quite splintered right now politically at the top, though obviously Erdogan is still extraordinarily powerful and has, you know, the police, the military, the parliament, and the nationalist movement on the right all on his side.
Well, let me switch gears just for a moment here and ask, how goes the effort to recognize the Armenian genocide within the halls of the United States Congress and the executive branch?
Well, you know, a great success was made about a year ago or so. Nancy Pelosi led the fight, and others, the so-called Armenian lobby or the Armenian caucus in Parliament, in Congress, and they actually passed the resolution in one house, in the democratically led House of Representatives. But it never got any further than that, and obviously Trump, who's a close friend now, a kind of odd friendship, really, you know, between Erdogan and Trump. They're both very similar characters. They both are quite corrupt. They both are, you know, authoritarian in their nature, and they seem to love strong men. And apparently Trump likes Erdogan because he thinks of him as strong. On several important phone calls, of course, Trump has outwitted, Erdogan has outwitted Trump and got him to withdraw troops from the Syrian border and let the Turks come in and destroy the the Kurdish little republic that had been set up there. And many people, including our own Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, resigned as a result of Trump's policies favoring Erdogan.
So there's this, apparently then, if I understand it correctly, it's not likely that the Republican-led Senate is going with no help from the executive branch here, from President Trump, it's not likely that there's going to be any further movement in recognizing the Armenian genocide as long as President Trump remains in some kind of friendly relationship with Erdogan.
That's absolutely correct. The problem is that even progressive, more progressive, liberal Democrats like President Obama promised to recognize the genocide.
Yeah.
He even has a high advisor who had written a book about how we should do this, Samantha Power.
Yeah, I knew that.
When push came, right? And she now wrote her memoir about how she regrets that she didn't fight for this. She, in fact, went the other way while she was in power and our ambassador to the UN. In general, the moral question of recognizing the genocide is put on the back burner, because on the front burner is the all-important alliance with Turkey that sits in that strategic region in the northern Middle East between Russia and its former republics and the rest of the Middle East and Israel. So, you know, that's a pretty big question. And the Armenian genocide seems, you know, slightly less relevant to the powers that be, unfortunately.
It may be the morally right thing to do, but there's too much of a political price to pay for it, it sounds like.
Yeah, I once argued in the New York Times on the 100th anniversary of the genocide, which was only a few years ago, and 5 years ago in 2015, that by not recognizing the genocide, what the United States does is play into the hands of Erdogan and the most conservative, most anti-European, most anti-democratic forces in Turkey.
Yeah.
If you recognize the genocide, then you're making not only a moral statement, you're also saying, we think you have to face up to history and move in a much more democratic direction.
Now, very good point. Very good point. Professor, thank you so much for being with me today, and I really appreciate the help.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Again, Professor Ronald Suny is a distinguished professor of history at the University of Michigan. And this, we'll come back to this question of Hagia Sophia as a museum, as a mosque, as a church. It's recognized as an important architectural landmark.
The Call, a call from God. Father Mitch Pacwa shares his experience.
I certainly had a bit of opposition. My father wasn't pleased with this at all, and he kept arguing with me. Once when I was 12, he said to me, what do you want to be a priest for? Why don't you be a doctor? You don't have to be a priest to help people. You can be a doctor and get married and have kids. And I said to him then, Dad, if I was a doctor and I help people get better, that would be very good. But later on, they're going to die anyway. So if I'm a priest and I hear somebody's confession and they go to heaven, that lasts forever. So that's better. And he didn't know what to say. And he continued to oppose the idea over the next years. Yet that didn't stop me. And even when he said, I'm going to disinherit you if you become a priest. And on the day of my first Mass, he did. But as I also said to him then, he told me, okay, you're out of my will. I said, Dad, I can't keep it anyway. It doesn't matter. I'm a Jesuit, and we can't keep the money, so it really doesn't affect me. The issue is I'm trying to follow what God, our Lord, is asking of me. And this has been where I have found the greatest joy, that doing what I believe through my own prayer and through reflection and thinking about it and moving from a little boy's idea of what a priest would be like all the way to now in my early 50s, you know, realizing that this is exactly what I think is going to please God the most. And that's what I want to do, to please God.
For information on the priesthood or religious life, Log on to www.ewtn.com/religious life.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at avemariaradio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to avemariaradio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Here's the new challenge. At least 1 hour a week in front of the Blessed Sacrament, with the goal of an hour a day in front of the Blessed Sacrament. I had a guy come up to me and he says, Father, you know, I'm doing a lot of things. I'm in a men's fellowship. I pray with my wife every day. I go to Mass every Sunday and usually a couple times during the week. I read Scripture. He goes, I want more. I said, do you pray in front of the Blessed Sacrament? He said, outside of Mass, no. I said, I think that's the more. See, all these saints, these are the ones who surround us. These are the ones who ran before us. These are the ones who fought well, who kept the faith. They would tell you, as would every single saint in heaven right now, you cannot run this race if you don't spend time with the Master. Whatever else we're doing, it's second, third, and fourth. First things need to be first. And the first thing is to be with the Master. And the Master is Jesus.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. Your search for affordable health care stops here. Since 2014, CMF Curo has provided Catholics with affordable health care sharing that goes beyond insurance. With programs that cost less than many COBRA and ACA-sponsored plans, CMF Curo is a Catholic health sharing experience that enables you to live fully alive while saving money. Call 1-833-GET-CURO to find affordable Catholic health care now. That's 1-833-GETCURO.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. As in the United States, we continue to hear that there are COVID cases are rising again. It's important for us to go and take a look at what's happening around the globe. With me right now, Mindy Belz, who's senior editor of World Magazine, author of They Say We Are Infidels, On the Run from ISIS with Persecuted Christians in the Middle East. And she's been writing recently on the problems in Belgium right now, which it's about the size of Maryland, but it has the highest mortality rate in Europe per 100,000. Mindy, good to have you here. Thanks.
Hi, Al. Good to be with you.
In World Magazine, you've been covering this, and I remember when I was looking just a few weeks ago, I was just kind of get a feel for the nations of the world and how they were responding to COVID-19. And I saw the mortality rate was highest in Belgium. And I said, why? What? I would have thought that Belgium would have handled this pretty well. What in the world happened there?
Yeah, it is pretty striking. And even now, I've been watching this for a couple of months, and the number of cases there is coming down, as it is in much of Europe, unlike the U.S. And yet the death rate in Belgium has held steady at about, between 9 and 10,000 total deaths. And that's just, as you say, that's a lot for a tiny country. Most of those deaths have been in nursing homes, largest percentage. And, you know, early on, they just did a couple of things that are now looking like they kind of gave elderly people living in residential care facilities a death sentence. Oh. They put the facilities on lockdown. They also prevented hospitalizations of people living in these residential care facilities for COVID-19 or for anything else. They just prevented patients being transferred to hospitals. And as a result, it just created really awful situation, as we would find here. Residential care facilities, nursing homes, for the most part, are not equipped for the kind of severe symptoms that elderly people have been developing with COVID-19.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have good ways to treat them, even if they had sicknesses they could have recovered from.
Is there a logic to this? I mean, is it because they mistakenly thought that these, elderly care facilities had sufficient equipment to handle COVID-19 symptoms? Or is it just ignoring the old people?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I think you have a political situation in Belgium that is, that is less stable than what you'd think in an advanced European country. They've had essentially a caretaker government for about a year. So you've had all these overlapping bureaucracies of their national government and then their provincial governments and creating some confusing directives. That was one issue. I think they didn't take the risk to the elderly population seriously. And one of the reasons that we started looking into it really deeply is, if you'll recall, as I'm sure most of your audience knows, Belgium has most liberal euthanasia laws in the world.
Yep.
And so, the question, and bioethicists, pro-life groups in Belgium, who we've been in touch with for a long time, they were immediately asking those questions. Are people in nursing homes being allowed to die behind a lockdown where parents can't check on them?
Mm-hmm.
Not parents, but family members cannot check on them. Accountability is lacking. What's happening? And we learned some disturbing things. We learned that some family members were asked to sign these extensive consent forms that seemed to be allowing for things that can lead certainly to euthanasia,
mm-hmm.
things like sedation, that sedation was becoming a form of treatment for COVID-19. In other words, they didn't have ventilators. So to ease the respiratory distress, which brings on a lot of panic, they were sedating people. And you just can't do that for days upon days upon days without a lot of really advanced monitoring.
Well, I would imagine, too, that sedation is probably a central nervous system depressant, too, which reduces respiration.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. For all of us, we're in the middle of this right now. And so a lot of these things are not going to become clear until we've had a chance to collect more data and be able to look back. But already it's looking pretty grim. In Belgium, I'm a little bit encouraged in a discouraging situation that since our story has come out, a number of journalists have begun looking into this more seriously.
Good.
In Belgium, I've gotten a couple of reports and a couple of inquiries. Only a few have actually visited these nursing homes and been granted access to be able to kind of see exactly what's going on.
Wow. What have you been able to get a sense of how Christians have been responding there, how churches have been responding to this in Belgium?
Well, I think that the church, as we've seen in the United States, the church is trying to do what the church does, which is reach out and help people. And there have been a number of ministries that have been involved in food care. One of the most interesting things in the course of doing this story was discovering this very small group called the Chapel for Europe, which is an ecumenical choir that began singing outside these nursing homes as they realized how many people were sick and were dying. And it became such a thing. They were only able to do it for a short period of time, once a week, because of how strict the lockdown was in Belgium. But people in these nursing homes would come to their windows. They began recognizing people by their windows, and they would come to their windows just to hear them sing, about 12 to 15 people, maybe 20 on a good Sunday afternoon. And it just became a real community builder. So as we've seen in our own country, there are ways of building community even in isolation. And so this picture of these elderly people, some of them sick, coming out of their beds and standing by their windows just to hear music is, I think, a beautiful thing in a real ministry.
It's got to be difficult doing rehearsals for a choir, isn't it?
Yeah. This is a traveling choir. The director of it is a woman who works, named Louisa Karnowski from Poland, works in Brussels with the European Commission. And, you know, suddenly she's working from home. She can't visit her own family, can't travel. So she was looking for something to do, and the choir was meeting via Zoom to continue rehearsals. And someone had the idea, hey, my mom is in a nursing home. Do you think we could meet outside and sing for her? And that's how it began.
That's great. They haven't, have they been given a lot of freedom, or have they been, has it been difficult for them to gain access even to the outside?
The lockdowns in Europe have been much more severe than what we've experienced in the United States. So, for instance, for months, only one family member could be designated to go outdoors to do essential errands like grocery shopping. Wow. That has come off in the last couple of weeks, and people are beginning to be able to go out without some of those restrictions. But we are seeing, the last day that I talked to one of the directors of one of the nursing homes that we profile in the story, he said, just as of this week, we're allowing family members to come back and visit. So the number of cases has begun to decline. But again, we're continuing to watch, because the death rate is remaining high. And I think that's something that, in this situation where there's so many things are unknown, we all want to be able to learn from one another. And I feel like it's just been very hard to get a sense of what's going on in other places so that they can help us all make better decisions.
Right.
And I think we're going to keep watching Belgium. Good. For that reason.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you're doing it. You've had a lot of experience, I know, working in Syria years ago, or maybe just last year even. But tell me a little bit about Syria's situation with COVID-19.
Sure. In fact, we just had news yesterday of the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in northwest Syria. Northwest Syria is the place that continues to be what I'd call hot, where there's active battle going on between the Assad government forces and some of these militias that are linked to al-Qaeda, some that are backed by the Turkish government. You've had Turkey facing off against Russian forces, just kind of a chaotic situation there. And in that same area, there was one confirmed case. However, I mean, that sounds like, given the context of the world situation, maybe not a big deal. It is a big deal when, I mean, doctors and aid workers there are telling me, we've seen hundreds of cases of COVID-19.
Yeah.
We just haven't had any ability to test them. And the other situation there is that nearly every hospital has been destroyed by this long war.
Ugh.
And so there's just zero capacity for treating an outbreak. And all of the people that we've been talking to are still inside Syria, have been just trying to do everything they could to prevent even one case, because it's really hard to know what's going to happen. Once we see this take off. And so I think we will. I think we already, there's enough evidence that there already are some outbreaks. Now some testing is getting in, and I think it's going to be, again, because of travel restrictions, so hard for us to know what's actually happening, but certainly of real concern.
Mm. How about other nations in the Middle East, like, say, Iraq? Do we know much what's going on there?
Also a spike. A couple of cities, Baghdad is particularly bad. The city of Mosul, which, as you know, was held by ISIS for about 3.5 years. And Mosul also, like we're talking about in Syria, is a city that is largely devastated. And 9 of 13 hospitals in Mosul were destroyed during the battle to liberate the city. One of them that was rebuilt by Doctors Without Borders is now the center for treating COVID-19 patients. It's full of them. They have a rising number of cases, and are, doing the best they can, like we all are.
Thanks, Mindy. How do people get a hold of World Magazine so they can follow your work?
at worldmag.com is a great way to see us online, and then you can link to my stories there just by doing a search.
Very good. Thanks, Mindy. We'll talk soon.
People ask how they can care for older family members who can't fully care for themselves. One answer is Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care. Visiting Angels assists adults nationwide with 600 locations to continue living at home and not have to move into a nursing home. Their caregivers provide assistance in hygiene, meals, and light housework. Services are provided up to 24 hours per day, and you can select your caregiver before service begins. More information, including franchise opportunities, is on the web at visitingangels.com.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization, Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 80% of the referral check to Ave Maria Radio and Students for Life. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
The EWTN home video highlight for July is The Heresies, Gnosticism. Christianity has fought against this heresy from the beginning, and its errors still infiltrate our culture today. Order your DVD of The Heresies, Gnosticism at EWTNRC.com, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
This is Dr. Stan Williams. Why do Christians believe what they do? Not what, but why? What are the facts, evidences, and reasons for the Christian faith? Nineveh's Crossing has just released a new book titled Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons. It's a religious education course for teens through adults in Christian history, archaeology, and logic. Basic Christianity, available now at AveMariaRadio.net in the bookstore. Look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
How does man fulfill his vocation? Through life in the Holy Spirit, the Catechism tells us. This life is made up of divine charity and human solidarity and is offered as salvation. Man's great dignity is rooted in his creation in the image and likeness of God. It is fulfilled in his vocation to divine beatitude. It is by our own actions, doing good and avoiding evil, freely chosen acts, that man conforms to the good promised by God. Human beings make their own contribution to their own interior growth, the Catechism tells us. With the help of grace, man can avoid sin and grow in virtue. It is Christ who reveals the mystery of the Father and his love for man, thus making man fully manifest to himself and bringing to light his exalted vocation. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
Want a simple way to add years to your life? Practice optimism. In a study of over 70,000 people, researchers at Boston University found that optimistic people lived up to 15% longer and were 70% more likely to live past 85 than less optimistic people. Optimism is the belief that we can make good things happen, even when things are going badly. Optimism isn't a trait you have or you don't. It's a skill we can all cultivate. As St. Paul says in Romans 8:28, we know that all things work for the good of those who love God. Get in the habit of asking God to help you make good things happen, even out of the bad things life throws at you. That simple habit might unlock the secret to a long and abundant life. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Every week we try to do a little roundup of church-related news, which we can look at some stories which may not, may not merit an entire segment, but are still something to be aware of and worth talking about. Joining me right now to do that is Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Executive Editor and Washington Bureau Chief for EWTN News, a Senior Fellow at the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, author, co-author of more than 50 books, and I have to say, I am so grateful that you've been able to guest host for me, Matthew. Thank you.
Oh, it is always a privilege, and I always give a shout-out to your incredible guys who helped me when I do the show. And all of them. They're wonderful to work with, and they make it so easy. I always joke they prove even I can do it.
People don't realize that you cannot sound decent, plausible, good, excellent on the air unless you've got some great people behind you. So, yes,
absolutely.
I agree. Well, let me talk with you about a few stories. I'd like to hear from you. Let's take the one that's pretty easy to understand, and that is the Notre Dame Cathedral spire is going to be rebuilt. And there was some controversy.
Right.
Yeah, there was some controversy about that. What was the controversy about?
Well, the controversy was how it was going to be rebuilt. There was no question that Notre Dame Cathedral, once they established that it structurally could be rebuilt, remember there were a couple of weeks there where there were some genuine structural concerns on the part of engineers. Were the walls going to be capable of standing the reconstruction and everything else? Once that was clear, the big fight was over the spire. And the spire itself is a late addition to the cathedral, and it became something of a firefight politically and culturally because Emmanuel Macron was open, apparently, to the idea of having a inventive reconstruction of the cathedral with a more contemporary design is how some of this was put forward.
Yeah.
So instead of simply having the original look of the building, and instead of simply rebuilding it to the best that we could using the greatest modern techniques,
mm-hmm.
We had various people being encouraged to post suggestions for what this might look like,
mm-hmm.
and the results, unfortunately, were pretty predictable.
Yeah, okay. So nothing. So that's been settled, though, right? It's going to be rebuilt as a replica of the pre-fire design.
That's right. Now, by way of reminding everyone that I think we certainly dodged a major bullet here, there was the right, essentially, for the government to force the reconstruction to take the form that they might choose, mainly because of the 1905 law that separating church and state, that really what's known as laïcité is a kind of public secularism, and essentially all the religious buildings in France are the property of the French government.
Wow.
So fortunately, there was a real groundswell of support by Parisians, by French architects, by pretty much the whole of the country. No, if we're going to rebuild this, let's do it properly. Some of the ideas for replacing the spire included a swimming pool, a greenhouse, and the one that, especially given the news today about the Hagia Sophia, someone actually proposed that in the interest of remembering the age of colonialism, that they build a minaret on the top of Notre Dame Cathedral because of France's history in North Africa, especially in Algeria.
Oh, in Algeria. I mean, you just... Who can make suggestions like that with a straight face? I mean,
well, they seem to manage.
All right. Well, I'm glad it's being restored. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And
yes,
I think in America, though, learning in America, we generally think that the way we do things in church-state relations is probably better than anywhere else in the world. So when you hear that France has an entirely different policy in which the state owns the church properties and the buildings, and you say to yourself, how can they live with that? But they do.
Well, they do. And it's a reminder, though, too, of the complicated, even tortured history of the church in France.
Yeah.
Think of France as a traditionally French country, and yet here we've had a number of historical moments in which we had things called Gallicanism, we had the French Revolution, we had the wholesale persecution of the church and of the French revolutionaries and the Napoleon Bonaparte, and then we had the different republics leading up to that 1905 law of laïcité. So it's more complicated than people think, and while it is still ostensibly a Catholic country, the depth of secularism now really can't be underestimated, and that's the truth that we find across all of Europe and, unfortunately, increasingly even here in the United States.
Well, let me switch to another European country, Germany, where a survey released, I guess it was last week, found that 30%, again, it might have been actually yesterday. I'm just looking at my notes here. Found that 30% of German Catholics are considering leaving the church. And we also know that one of the reasons they're planning on leaving is that they simply don't want to pay the church tax anymore.
That's right. Yeah, here we were just talking about the Laicite and that complicated relationship. In Germany, you have, because of a Konkordat, or an agreement between church and state, a church tax.
Yeah.
And that extends not just to the Catholic Church, but, of course, to the Lutheran Church. And it really gives me no satisfaction or joy in any way to say that if the numbers that you just were citing, we can look at those again in a second, were terrible, they're even worse for the Lutherans.
Yeah.
So what this means really is with about 22.6 million German Catholics, that is a marked decline, even about 5% just in about 2 years. We're seeing general levels of dissatisfaction with the church in Germany. We're seeing secularism. So where it gets important then is a number of people who say that they would consider leaving. You have to go and formally renounce your membership in order to exclude yourself from the automatic tithe or tax. So that's one of the big reasons why people do that.
So 8 to 9% of their income goes to the church if you're registered as a Catholic there. If they say they're not no longer Catholic, they formally disaffiliate with the Catholic Church, do they save that 8 to 9%, or does the state move it somewhere else?
Yes, my understanding is that that is actually money saved.
Okay.
And now, I could be mistaken in that, but that's always been my understanding in that. And part of it, too, is an increasing recognition that the German church, because of the church tax, is actually one of the wealthiest anywhere in the world.
Right.
And,
and they're the second largest employer in Germany.
That's right, with massive financial holdings, even after the sex abuse cases and other things, which is one of the reasons why, if you remember last year in the Amazonian Synod, it seemed strange to people that the German church, that the German bishops, for example, should be so heavily involved in what was a pan-Amazonian regional synod.
Right.
The reason for that was because the German diocese, especially under Cardinal Reinhard Marx, the Archbishop of Munich, have invested massively in various evangelizing enterprises around the world. And in fairness, the German church has historically been very generous. But the fact remains that when you have the Germans now embarking on this synodal path, as they're calling it, or synodal way, in which they're looking to completely dismantle the church's teachings, especially in sexual morality and governance and sacraments, that influence then, I think, is contributing to some of the disillusionment.
Yeah.
I, based on the numbers that we see with the Lutheran church, I think it is pretty safe to say that most people are not leaving the German church because we don't ordain women.
Right. I mean, that's something to consider. I mean, look, the four categories here, they got this synodal way that you're referring to. It's supposed to bring lay people and bishops together to discuss four topics. Those topics are the way power is exercised in the church, sexual morality, the priesthood, the role of women. Now, the way power is exercised in the church, I guess you can talk about, abuses of power and things of that sort. Sexual morality, these are kind of moral absolutes. I mean, sexual morality isn't something that can be negotiated.
That's right.
The priesthood. Well, that's usually code for wanting to ordain women. Mm-hmm. And then they also have explicitly the role of women in the church, again, which usually means ordination of women. As though somehow these are the reasons people are leaving the church. The real problem people leave the church is because they're bored. They have chosen a different way of life. And in some cases, they've been improperly treated. And then if you're going to save 9% of your income by leaving the church and you don't have a vibrant faith in Jesus Christ, heck, give me the 9%. I'm out of here. The only thing I lose is I can't be buried in a Catholic sacred ground, and I can't receive the sacraments, which I don't care about anyways.
Right. I mean, if you have lost your faith and you have lost all trust in the leadership of the church, and your faith life is virtually non-existent because you're so secular. There's very little incentive here. And again, we have seen the embrace of all of these ideas on the part of the Lutheran Church, which historically has been very, very significant in the life of Germany. And their numbers are worse, as I was saying.
Yeah.
And one thing that I would come back to, though, is that the 28-page letter to German Catholics that Pope Francis wrote.
That's a very good point. Yes, bring this up. Yeah.
Last year, in I think it was June of 2018, basically when they were still trying to talk about this. And he said that every time an ecclesial community has tried to get out of its problems alone, relying solely on its own strengths, methods, and intelligence, it has ended up multiplying and nurturing the evils it wanted to overcome. I think that's a perfect little distillation, I think, of the concerns that everyone has. And Pope Francis has asked them to pursue the way forward, the synodal way that he has laid out in his pontificate. And ironically, Cardinal Reinhard Marx, who up until just recently was the head of the German Episcopal Conference, seems to have set aside Pope Francis's own vision of a synodal path for one of the Germans' own making.
Yeah. Pope Francis said, look, if you're having difficulty there, if numbers are deteriorating, evangelize. You have to get out and present the gospel.
Right, and go back to the basics.
Yeah. I want to make sure I get one other story in with you today, and that is a very happy story. Conjoined twins that were operated on at Vatican Hospital. There was separation surgery there. Tell us that story.
Well, this is one of those great happy stories that I think we need more of at the moment. And basically, that the two twins who were conjoined from Africa, they were in the Central African Republic, were able to come and be brought to Italy for a remarkable separation surgery at the Bambino Gesù Hospital in Rome. And not to appreciate the sheer complexity of it, it took a surgery involving neurosurgeons and others in three different stages to begin the separation because they were joined at their head. And apparently, they are turning out just fine. But you've got forms of cranial and cerebral fusion, and simply talking about that and trying to make all of that work was an immense achievement, and it's a testament, I think, to what can be achieved when we actually have the will to do it. But one of the things that I loved most about this story is that there was an ethics committee that oversaw all of this to make sure that this is being done in the most ethical way possible.
Yeah. Well, this is, again, one of those great stories. We'll have it posted in the guest archives as well. Matthew, thank you much. Great talking with you again.
Always good to be with you. God bless.
Dr. Matthew Bunsen, again, Register Radio, reminding you, it's on Saturdays at 7 p.m., Sundays at 11 a.m.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What's looking back at you at age 22? What do you hope to say about that child at age 22? If you're content to say, well, the way kids are turning out nowadays, counting my blessings. Parole officer says one of the nicest children he has. Or would you rather say he's 1 in 100? Morals, compassion, seeks God. Are you prepared to be a 1 in 100 parent then? You can't parent like the bulk of parents anymore. You will supervise far higher. You will screen out toxic media sewage at a rate unlike all of your friends, perhaps your family. No guarantees as to what will be looking back at you at age 22. But you want to be able to say, I think he's 1 in 100. Then you be a 1 in 100 parent.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
And so God looked at everything he had made and found it very good.
I suppose that includes what some biologists call junk DNA, what cosmologists call dark matter, what physicists suggest are hidden dimensions, or how time can distort space and gravity twist light. Atheists claim that science has the answers to everything. But in fact, as humans, when it comes to most of the universe, we have no idea. In our wisdom, we call the ubiquitous junk, dark, hidden, distorted, and twisted. Can the mysteries of the universe be all those things and still be very good? Impossible? We have no idea. But God knows, and one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net, under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. I want to come back just briefly to this situation in France and Germany. I believe the United States, in the way it approaches, generally speaking, the way it approaches church-state relations, is the right way to do it. Not the only way to do it, I understand. And the church doesn't insist, on one particular way. It can, the Catholic Church has often even favored confessional states. It doesn't do so any longer. But you have had that in the past. But I'd like you to just think about this, what it would be like living in a country in which 8-9% of your income, if you're a Catholic, goes directly to the church. In other words, you're taxed. What do you think that does to free will giving? In America, churches have learned that if they want to sustain themselves, they have to be supported by the free will offerings of those members who voluntarily associate with them. That's Germany. In France, Christian communities can't even buy their own churches, own their own churches. The state owns them. Next hour, we'll take a long look
this
at the Lord's Prayer.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story. Story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program. It's
clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations. Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for being with me for another hour, talking about the things that matter most. This hour, we will talk about maybe the prayer that matters most to a lot of us, the Lord's Prayer. We regularly pray it. We learned it. A lot of us learned it while we were still learning to speak. It's one of the most important prayers ever given to the human family. And yet, who of us hasn't taken it for granted, right? We're hastily reciting it, repeating it, not able to grasp its depth, maybe sometimes even avoiding its depth and meaning. But I want to spend time on it today with Father Jeffrey Kirby, who's joined me a few times in the past on a number of topics. And I think he has a wonderful touch at helping us slide into and better understand some of these important devotional aspects of our Catholic faith. The prayer is a list of seven distinct petitions we ask of God, so we're going to look at that. What is it about daring to call God Father? Again, this is something we don't realize how novel this was in the world, to call God our Father. Or deliver us from evil, which New Testament scholars often say is better translated, deliver and protect us from the evil one, in referencing, you know, the great Satan. So we're going to spend time taking a look at that. We'll look over some of the overlooked words in that prayer. What does it mean to pray for our daily bread? Pray this day for what? Our daily bread. You mean the bread for today? That's coming up. Also, we're going to spend time with Doug Keck, who is serves as president and chief operating officer for EWTN. A few topics I want to talk over with Doug, Black Lives Matter and some others. But first, the news.
Thanks, Al. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, July 10th. It's the Feast of St. Veronica Giuliani. Today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow says the Trump administration will not tolerate another national shutdown amid ongoing coronavirus concerns. Speaking to reporters, he said President Trump will do everything in his power to prevent it. Kudlow added that the president is pressing very hard to open schools in the fall as well. He said K-12 schools and colleges should reopen with health and safety guidelines in place. Tropical Storm Fay is dropping heavy rainfall and strong winds across the mid-Atlantic coast. The National Weather Service said the storm center approached maximum sustained winds of 60 miles per hour this morning. The storm has forced President Trump to postpone tomorrow's rally in New Hampshire. The president's reelection campaign said his visit to Portsmouth will be scheduled very soon due to bad weather. President Trump says he'll be looking at a possible pardon for longtime ally Roger Stone.
Well, I'll be looking at it. I think Roger Stone was very unfairly treated, as were many people. And in the meantime, Comey and all these guys are walking around, including Biden and Obama, because we caught them spying on my campaign.
Stone is scheduled to begin a prison term next week after being convicted of lying to Congress, witness tampering, and obstruction. Amazon is telling employees to remove TikTok from their phones due to a security risk. The video app is owned by a Chinese company and has been under scrutiny as a potential national security threat. Workers must delete the app by today if they want to keep mobile access to their Amazon email. The tech giant says they can view TikTok from their laptop. TikTok says it's committed to user privacy and doesn't understand Amazon's concerns. I'm Steve Clark, Ave Maria Radio News.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, and I'm pleased to be joined right now by Doug Keck, President, Chief Operating Officer of EWTN. And Doug, good to have you with me. Thanks.
It's always great to be on with you, Al. Thanks for asking me.
Let me, because I don't want to, sometimes we get talking about things, and then I forget to focus on some new things that EWTN is doing and our programming decisions that are coming up. I know you've got shows coming up on St. Benedict, Padre Pio, and Lord's Week. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, obviously, we have a docudrama on Benedict that is going to be airing tonight, and then we have a whole week of Lourdes with our friars. Father Joseph and Father John Paul went over there, so we produced a whole series of half-hour shows run all next week. And then nice. There's also that big pilgrimage event they're kind of doing electronically, virtually, and we'll be carrying that as well, happening next week. And if you can go to EW10.com, you can check out our /television. You'll get all the information on all the different programs we have going on. We've got a, you know, we're going to be having Padre Pio talked about on the Wednesday live show with Father Mitch and Colin Donovan. We got a video that one of our guys produced about kind of like a miracle of Padre Pio, one of the times where he bilocated and showed up in front of the Pope. And so it's a little segment. Wow. We're going to show that, which we're very proud of. And yeah. So we look forward to that. So that's just some of the material we have. And, of course, just always remind people that so many of our programs are available on demand, 25,000-plus programs, more than anybody else as far as Catholic. And
wow.
And we want to remind people also we're at 1.2 million and counting for our app, so people can check that out as well. So there, You can find us on Facebook, EW10's everywhere, as we like to say.
On-demand programming is becoming so necessary now. You go back when you and I were growing up, and you had basically three television stations locally that you'd watch, an ABC affiliate, an NBC affiliate, a CBS affiliate. And then there's probably, out of New York anyways, there was always an educational channel that we used to get.
Right, and a couple of others. There was Metro Media, WOR. It was like three others because that was the biggest market.
So, yeah,
right.
Yeah. And we didn't even get those in New Haven, so, 90 miles away.
But at least you get to watch the Jets or Giants games, which we couldn't see because they were blacked out.
Oh gosh. But it's amazing now because a person doesn't even have to worry about when something is airing, because it's becoming the assumption that if it airs at any time, I'll be able to somehow get it on demand in right. the near future. How does that, has that changed the way that you think at EWTN?
Well, certainly I think what we understand is that there is a linear aspect to life that people enjoy. And certainly I think for some of our older audience, that's comfortable. It's there. They know it's there. They can count on it there. It's the same way each day, and it moves through that pattern. For others, a lot of younger people in that who are have time differences as far as when they want to watch things, again, with DVRs and sling boxes and YouTube channels and everything now. Everything's built with the idea of basically having the ability of recording whatever you'd like, and if you miss it, you can probably find it. And, it's kind of the attitude that we kind of had for the good or the bad of it right now, which is kind of I want what I want when I want it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Which kind of lapped over into the whole media, or maybe comes out of our home kind of multimedia experience. But because that's what people are used to, you have to make it user-friendly for the way people deal with their lives and with media. Otherwise, you get left behind. That's why, sometimes I think people are always amazed at the amount of multi-platform material that people like us and even some of the stuff that you guys do, that we're out there doing that. They're thinking, well, they're clunking along with the old style, they're showing the mask and that's about it. And then they go to Facebook and they see everything that's going on and being streamed in multiple languages around the world. They're always somewhat shocked.
Right,
and that's why we've always tried to get that out there, because the toughest thing we have, and I'm sure you've had it many times too, is the person who suddenly stumbles upon, Ave Maria or EWTN and says, why didn't somebody ever tell me about this before?
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
And you go, well, we're trying. Sometimes you need to look maybe, and you wonder yourself, why isn't this being broadcast throughout the diocese in the sense of telling people about it? Or this wonderful, wonderful treasure that's there. But unfortunately, it's not the way the Lord works,
Yeah.
It's why EW10's in Birmingham, Alabama.
which continues to amaze me.
That's the idea.
That's right. Yeah, this is the way the Lord does things.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you about a controversial topic, about Black Lives Matter, which there's no doubt that the phrase originates from a radical left-wing organization opposed to so many things that Catholics believe.
Right.
And yet the phrase has kind of drifted into the mainstream. Even the NBA is thinking of putting Black Lives Matter on the floor, off the court, but on the,
right,
on the side. And if there's any audience that doesn't need to be reminded that Black Lives Matter, it's people who love NBA. I mean, everything from Wilt Chamberlain and Bill Russell to LeBron James.
Right.
They know Black Lives Matter. But how do you go about, when you have a public controversy like mm-hmm. this, how do you think about it there at EWTN?
Well, I think the difficult thing for most people is clearly that we all agree that Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
That Black lives as individuals, as whatever you want to describe, a race or a group of people or people from a particular part of the world or whatever their tonality happens to be, of course they matter. The problem is it gets melded together with this organization,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of, in a sense, co-opted the concept, where they get melded together. So people who are like, listen, of course Black Lives Matter, but I don't support this organization,
right,
and I don't support the riots in the street. I might support protests. I might support,
sure,
you know, reforming the police, but defunding the police is ridiculous, especially when you see what goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And so people are forced to kind of stipulate and try to say, well, yes and no. But the trouble is, in the kind of cancel culture we live in today, every utterance that isn't done profoundly is jumped on. You know, you didn't say it quick enough.
Yeah.
You know, there's an old line from Charlie Brown when Lucy asks him, you know, you do think I'm beautiful, don't you, Charlie Brown? You know, and he goes, well, you didn't answer fast enough. You know what I mean? So it's that kind of idea that you get jumped on. And so what happens is people end up saying nothing. Or it's kind of like the organization, the Human Rights League, I think it's called, or something similar to that. Well, the group is really, the actual group itself is a gay activist.
That's right.
That's really
Human Rights Watch, right.
Human Rights Watch. But everybody would say, are you for human rights? Oh, of course I'm for human rights.
Exactly.
You know, of course I'm for human rights. Of course I'm for black lives. They matter. Hispanic lives matter. White lives matter. Just like somebody said to you, is white lives matter? You'd say, sure. But if there was some group, and maybe there is one called White Life Matter that's a white supremacy neo-Nazi group, you'd say, well, I certainly don't support them.
Right, right. Exactly, exactly. This is one of those things that we just continually have to deal with, though, because we don't control the world's vocabulary. And so we have to make these distinctions so people understand. I know personally, I don't use the phrase Black Lives Matter because I don't want to grant any moral authority to the organization, even though I know many people, good people, don't even associate the phrase with the organization. They're not even aware there was this there is this revolutionary leftist organization that has started the started using the phrase way back around the time of I think George Zimmerman getting acquitted in the death of Trayvon Martin.
Right.
And yeah, so it goes back quite a way.
The Brown incident.
And then in Ferguson, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that was one of them.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's it gets to be very frustrating to have to get into these fights over words. But words are important, so you try to distinguish them as best as you can.
Well, that's the trouble. You pointed it out. I mean, it's the Orwellian world we live in today where words have new meanings poured into them.
Yeah.
And so what one person means by that word is not the same as whatever anyone else means. And because we're living in a world that's anti-objectivism,
yep,
not in the sense of Ayn Rand, but
right,
in the sense of an objective truth,
yeah,
where everything is, as Don Lemon would put it, you know, besides the fact that Jesus wasn't perfect, the fact that he speaks his truth, and that's the phrase you hear today. Well, this is my truth. Well, what is your truth? There is only a truth. You might have a perspective. You know, it's like there was a movie years ago called Rashomon. It was a great Japanese movie,
mm-hmm,
where you know, there's one person tells the story of what happened, and then there's another person. The other person involved tells the story, and then they show you what really happened. And that, you know what I mean? It's that whole idea of, each one of them had their truth, but it wasn't true.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of Don Lemon, Jesus Christ, if that's who you believe in, he said, Jesus Christ admittedly was not perfect when he was here on this earth. So I'm saying to myself, well, you know, Don, you can have, you know, any opinion you want about who Jesus Christ is, but on what grounds would you say he wasn't perfect when he was here on earth? And when does a mainstream, a so-called mainstream broadcaster treat the major figure, mm-hmm, in Western religion with such flippancy?
I wonder whether he would have said that about Muhammad.
Exactly, yeah.
And I think what they usually turn to, and you're the guy who looks through the world through the lens of the Bible, not me. I'm still looking for those lenses. Do you know where you can buy those? But the idea of, you know, looking at it and just seeing this kind of perspective from him, a guy who himself, who was raised Baptist and went to Catholic school.
Yeah.
So and had his catechism class and sat there talking to another gentleman who's an alleged Catholic. Who didn't say anything different. But usually I think they turn to Jesus getting mad at the temple. That seems to be the one where we can see
that's where they think
Jesus
okay.
lost his temper, so he's not perfect.
Yeah, so he was out of control somehow.
Right.
Gotcha. So that would be the grains of sand in the Parthenon. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Let's see. That's something else I wanted to talk to you about. Let me just pull up my notes. And I wanted to come back to this St. Benedict broadcast. When is that?
That's tonight. I think it's at 8 o'clock Eastern. But check out the web, EW10.com.
Very good. Doug, thanks. Great talking with you.
Thanks, Al.
Doug Keck, President and Chief Operating Officer of EWTN. Again, 8 o'clock tonight, St. Benedict.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
Awe. I love reverence. Wherever I go in the world, I usually go to visit the religious buildings. And no matter what I see reverence. Awe. I've been in temples and mosques where I saw more reverence and awe of God than I see in Christian churches, even sometimes in Catholic churches. Oh, yes. Let me say it. When I was a boy, Catholics were much more reverent and respectful in church. You never, ever spoke in church. I was a young priest. A man had a heart attack at the beginning of Mass. I stopped the Mass. We prayed for the man while the police were coming, the ambulance. They removed him from the church. He didn't die. Not one word was spoken. The police officers and the ambulance attendants who came whispered respect. I wish it were true today.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
There is genuine consolation from the Catholic Catechism regarding the death of a loved one. The Christian who dies in Christ Jesus, we are told, is away from the body and at home with the Lord. Death marks the end of a Christian's sacramental life, but the fulfillment of his new birth, which began at baptism, now has a definitive conformity to the image of Jesus Christ. The Christian funeral does not give the deceased a sacrament or sacramentals because he or she has passed beyond the sacramental economy. The different funeral rites express the paschal character of Christian death. The greatest consolation to the Christian is the knowledge that even in death, we are separated only temporarily, that one day, if we have lived well, we will all be together again in Christ. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
This is Dr. Stan Williams. Why do Christians believe what they do? Not what, but why? What are the facts, evidences, and reasons for the Christian faith? Nineveh's Crossing has just released a new book titled Basic Christianity, Facts, Evidences, Reasons. It's a religious education course for teens through adults in Christian history, archaeology, and logic. Basic Christianity, available now at AveMariaRadio.net in the bookstore. Look for me, Dr. Stan Williams.
There was no single event. It was more gradual. You know, eventually you just don't go one Sunday, and then you don't go two Sundays in a row. Then went through a divorce and ended up being a single parent. If I didn't have church or God, I would be back at that lonely stage, that trouble stage. Whenever you get anxious and worry about things, you just know that Jesus has it under control.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for any reason, visit CatholicsComeHome.org.
This program is brought to you in part by Charity Mobile, a proud partner of Ave Maria Radio for over 15 years. Charity Mobile is the pro-life cell phone company and has sent nearly $2 million to thousands of pro-life charities. 4G LTE coverage is available nationwide, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to your favorite pro-life charity. A video introduction is available at CharityMobile.com. Charity Mobile. Everyday living. Effortless giving. CharityMobile.com.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. The Lord's Prayer is something that many of us learned as children, and we've recited it time and time again. Of course, it's part of our liturgy as well. And I'm sure every one of us at one time or another, or many times even, have taken it for granted, just let it kind of roll over our lips and not really reflected very much on what we were saying. But the Lord's Prayer is, of course, not only a popular prayer, it is a brilliant prayer. It's got an internal structure to it. It's not just a collection of propositions, sitting on top of one another. But there's a real logic to it, a spiritual logic to it. And join me right now to help us unpack the Lord's Prayer and helping us to live the Lord's Prayer is Father Jeffrey Kirby, pastor at Our Lady of Grace Catholic Church in the Diocese of Charleston, South Carolina. He's the author of several books. We've discussed some of them here. Thy Kingdom Come, Living the Lord's Prayer in Everyday Life. Today is our focus. Also, Kingdom of Happiness, Living the Beatitudes in Everyday Life. And then Doors of Mercy, Exploring God's Covenant with You. And Father, it's good to have you back here. Thanks.
Thanks, Al. It's good to be on the show.
Let's talk about the internal structure of the Lord's Prayer to begin with, because I think for many people it's a revelation to realize that the propositions in the Lord's Prayer are not just there in a haphazard way. There's a logic to them. There's an intelligent structure to them. Talk to us a little bit about the structure.
Yes, so similar as you were saying at the lead-in, many of us have become so familiar with the Lord's Prayer. In fact, some of us learned to pray while we were learning how to speak.
Yeah.
And so it's just become a part of our life, part of our rhythm in terms of our prayer life, our liturgical life, even our cultural life historically. And so it's so easy, as you were saying, to just take this for granted and to just think that, well, this is just a set prayer, and forget that actually it was given to us by the Lord Jesus when the apostles, after they saw him praying night and day, Lord, beginning his day, concluding his day with prayer to the Father, after some time the apostles asking the Lord Jesus, Lord, teach us to pray. We can imagine Jesus saying, finally, they're asking. And it's from that petition, which is really the petition of every human heart, Lord, teach us to pray. Teach us how to commune with the Father and how to be one with God. And as the Lord taught the prayer, as you were saying, Al, there's a structure to it, because not only is this prayer an answer to a petition from the apostles and from us, but it's also a share in the Lord's own prayer life with the Father.
Yeah.
That as he comes back from prayer, the apostles ask. So Jesus is showing us the interiority of his own prayer to the Father. Incidentally, we see a reflection of this in the high priestly prayer in John chapter 17, that it follows almost the format given to us in the Lord's Prayer. And to your point, what is this format? Well, traditionally in the church, we would say there were seven petitions, seven tenets. And the first three pertain to our relationship with God. The last four pertain to our relationship with God, but also our neighbor. So the early fathers also saw not simply the Beatitudes, but also the Lord's Prayer as the fulfillment of the Decalogue of the Ten Commandments. So the Ten Commandments, of course, the first three being our relationship with God, the last seven with our neighbor. The early fathers would say that the Lord's Prayer actually fulfilled that spiritually, brought it to its completion by this division of three petitions and four petitions, our relationship with God and relationship with our neighbor. So these seven petitions kind of show us this flow, this rhythm of the Lord's own prayer. And the very rhythm he's trying to teach us.
Now, when the opening, Our Father, was that a novel development in the history of Hebrew spirituality?
Yes and no. And, we could look at the Old Testament and see references to God being the father of Israel. The prophet Hosea especially gives this very endearing image of God teaching Israel to walk as a father teaches his son. So the image or the approach to God as father was not completely foreign. However, no one would have addressed God the Father with such intimacy or direction as the Lord has taught us to. Mm-hmm. So it was almost this abstract removed fatherhood that God, that the Lord Jesus definitely brought and taught us to approach God, not in this abstract, but very much in this familial, personal, communal, relationship. Incidentally, I think it's very important that with the salutation, Jesus says, "Our Father."
Yes.
He immediately associates us with himself.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, that's interesting. So, he's actually, he's inviting us to join him in his prayer to our Father. Very good.
Yes.
Who are in heaven. We look to heaven as the place of God's residence. Is there more to just more to that than just locating God?
Yes. And I tell you, if we look at our world today and the things that are happening, especially in terms of, you know, the riots and the violence that's happening on our streets and our efforts to find authentic harmony and tranquility between peoples, here we have it. Our Father who art in heaven.
Yeah.
Who art in heaven, who is above and beyond all things
yep.
and all categories, who is true Father to all, that we are all his children, that, you know, not simply is heaven the place of his dwelling, but also it shows that we all have this identity, this shared unity in this one Father, this one heavenly Father. So above national identity, beyond race, beyond gender, that God here is the source of unity as our Heavenly Father.
Yeah. I remember also a hearing related to our Father who art in heaven. I remember some preacher saying, when you say our Father, make that O big enough to include all God's children.
So amen. I
always thought that was a wonderful illustration. And the idea, you know, you mentioned riots, we've got COVID-19, we've got unstable politics, we've got unstable international relationships. So we look, our Father who art in heaven also reminds us that there is someone who's not subject to all this flux that we're involved in. Someone is sovereign over these affairs. And I think, to me, that's reassuring.
Yes, and the peace that he gives, as the scriptures tell us, his peace is beyond all understanding, that you know, as he desires to bestow this peace upon us in this world, that peace is not contingent. It doesn't rely on the state of affairs of this world. Nothing can take that peace that he gives from each of our hearts. And it's worth fighting and preserving that peace in the midst of the fallenness and the struggles of our world.
When we say, hallowed be thy name, what's that declaring?
Yeah, so now that we left the salutation, our Father who art in heaven, now we enter the first of the three petitions, which pertain to God's name, God's kingdom, and God's will. So those first three. And we speak of God's name, we're acknowledging that the name of God shares in the majesty and the splendor of God himself. And when we declare that his name is holy and should be revered, we're acknowledging his own majesty, his own, thrice holiness that is to be honored and respected and shown homage. I like, you know, in the book I tell a funny story about the one person who keeps using the Lord's name in vain and God's name in vain. And her friend asks her, what is your father's name? And she says, well, my father's name's Larry. And then the friend keeps saying on different occasions, oh, my Larry. Oh, Larry. Oh. And the friend's like, why do you keep using my name, my father's name like that?
Larry Dam.
The other woman. And the woman responds, well, if you're going to, you know, profane my father's name, I'm going to profane yours. It's obviously a playful way to make the point that you know, this is the name of our Father. This is the name above all names that merits again our homage and our deep respect.
Do you think Jesus, in sharing that phrase with us, "Hallowed be Thy name," is also remembering back to Exodus 3, God reveals his name to Moses.
Yes, absolutely. The burning bush, the I am.
Yep.
I mean, the power of that name, of course, so revered by, the Jewish people and by early Christians that it was spelled in vowels, so it could not be pronounced.
Right.
Because it was believed, and we are unworthy to pronounce such a name. And I think that the hard part for, as Christian believers, the hard part is having such intimacy with God. We can oftentimes, if we're not careful, take his immediacy for granted and become overly casual with the highest of holiest things, such as God's name.
Yeah.
And that's a risk that, we are his friends and his children, not out of any merit, but out of this sheer goodness on his part.
Yeah.
And that should provoke even gratitude, which, by the way, the biblical notion of fear is precisely that, the sense of profound gratitude that we want to show no harm or disrespect to the one who has been so gracious to us. And so we speak of the fear of the Lord as the beginning of wisdom. Like, this is it, to fear out of gratitude that there be any offense given to his name or to God's majesty.
Yeah. Yeah, what a friend we have in Jesus, not what a buddy we've got in Jesus,
Exactly. And we have a friend in him because he has chosen to be our friend.
That's right. That's right.
We only reciprocate the invitation that only he could initiate.
Yeah, yeah. Very good. Do you want to point out Jesus' use, the I am statements that Jesus makes in the Gospel of John and how this may relate to hallowed be thy name?
Yes, very much. Anyone who understands, especially Exodus 3 and the giving of the divine name, and then reads John's Gospel, can see that, I think, some over 20 times the Lord will refer and to himself with the I am statement, clearly declaring his divinity.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the first time that hit me years ago. I could hardly sit up. It was just so overwhelming to see that. Father, hang in there. We'll come back on the other side of the break and continue. Thy kingdom come, living the Lord's Prayer in everyday life. Father Jeffrey Kirby.
This Ave Maria program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit CMF Curo. If you're facing uncertainty with your current healthcare plan, now is the time to join CMF Curo. You can join any time during the year. And CMF Curo offers flexible Catholic healthcare solutions for individuals, families, and employers. CMF Curo is your personal healthcare advocate. Contact them today at mycatholichealthcare.com. That's mycatholichealthcare.com.
This program is brought to you in part by the nonprofit St. Paul Street Evangelization. St. John Paul II stated that for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation. So we know we're called, but how do we do it? St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The EWTN home video highlight for July is The Heresies, Gnosticism. Christianity has fought against this heresy from the beginning, and its errors still infiltrate our culture today. Order your DVD of The Heresies, Gnosticism at EWTNRC.com, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or call 1-800-854-6316.
If you believe in the power of prayer, Ave Maria Radio invites you to look at their website to submit a prayer request at AveMariaRadio.net. Your prayer requests are shared with hundreds at the Dominican Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, the Servants of God's Love, the Monastery of the Blessed Sacrament Cloistered Nuns, the Family of Faith Apostolate, and the staff of Ave Maria Radio. Just go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the Community tab to submit your prayer request today.
The Call, a call from God. Father Vincent Serpa shares his experience.
It began when I was in second grade. I was preparing for my first Holy Communion, and I went with my mother and father to see The Bells of St. Mary's, the movie with Bing Crosby and Ingrid Bergman. He was the singing pastor, and she was the sister principal of the school. And at one point in the movie, the sister was being transferred out of the school, and it was very painful for her because she thought it was because of her disagreements with the pastor, and it was really because she was ill and didn't know it. There's a scene with her kneeling before the tabernacle in the convent chapel. And I had never seen anybody pray before a tabernacle before. I'd seen them pray before statues. But at this particular time in my life, I was learning about the real presence of the Blessed Sacrament in catechism class, and it made a lot of sense to me. The other thing that moved me was that she was doing the difficult thing because she loved the Lord, and that was very impressive to me. Shortly thereafter, at the catechism class, the sister that had been teaching the boys was transferred away. And I remember when they announced, my eyes filled with tears because I thought that she was doing the difficult thing because she loved the Lord. Again, that just galvanized that whole experience that I had had. And shortly after that, I was at my grandmother's house, and I noticed a picture of St. Martin de Porres, or a statue of him. He was Blessed Martin then, in a Mary Noel magazine. And under it said, Dominican Brother. So I came into the kitchen and I told my mother, I want to be one of those. Years later, I actually did. I became a Dominican lay brother. And then after further discernment, I decided that what the Lord was really calling me to was to be a priest, because I wanted to celebrate Mass. And that's the priest's principal function. It's what makes him a priest, is to celebrate that sacrifice. And that's what I did.
For information on the priesthood or religious life, log on to www.ewtn.com/religious-life.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Father Jeffrey Kirby, looking at the Lord's Prayer. Book, Thy Kingdom Come, Living the Lord's Prayer in Everyday Lives, filled with spiritual insights, really on every page. We were talking about the phrase, Hallowed Be Thy Name, at the close of last segment. And I wanted to spend just a moment more on that, because throughout the book, Father, you also link these tenets of the Lord's Prayer with certain of the Beatitudes as well. So in this case, Hallowed Be Thy Name, it engenders within us, of course, a fear of the Lord, extraordinary gratitude. But you also tie it then to, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Holy is your name really puts us in a position of humility.
Yes, very much. And I'm glad you referenced that chart in the book. Because all those connections, none of those I came up with. All those books I borrowed from, you know, spiritual masters in our tradition, from St. Augustine to St. Thomas Aquinas to the Desert Father Cassian, and used set things within our tradition to make those connections. And I think it's so important to see how they interact.
Yeah.
So as we were mentioning, the tenets of the Lord's Prayer, the Beatitudes, because the early church believed there were seven Beatitudes. The eighth that we call the eighth Beatitude was considered the commissioning. So seven Beatitudes, seven tenets of the Lord's Prayer, seven fruits of the Holy Spirit, gifts of the Holy Spirit, and then the seven Christian virtues. And then contrast those to the seven deadly sins. So here, obviously, you know, blessed are, you know, the humble and you know, those who especially, we can see how it relates to when we acknowledge God's name, when we realize His majesty, we realize where we are, and we begin to realize that there really is a poverty of spirit, that compared to God, we only have what He chooses to give us in His goodness. So the gifts He seeks to bestow upon us. I love the phrase from the letter of James, like every good gift comes from above, you know, the Father of lights.
Yeah.
And I think that very much that tenet of the Lord's Prayer and that beatitude very much direct us in that spiritual path of humility.
Let's go to Thy Kingdom Come. And you have some reflections back growing up in Cold War West Germany that tie into this. Go ahead and tell us the story.
Yeah, so very much, as you mentioned, I grew up in what was then West Germany during the Cold War. My father was in the military, and very much, you know, our presence in Germany was, you know, to preserve democracy and freedom and to assist the nation of Germany and preserving its independence. And so because of that, everything had to be controlled. So we had ID cards that, we had to carry at all times. It indicated, where we were, who we were, who we were responsible to, and various other, things that were just a part of living in a contained, highly mission-focused environment. That this was very important that everyone knew to follow certain rules and to have certain identification and so on. And I just drew from that, in that as members of the kingdom, as children of God, we have to have that same mission focus that God has entrusted to us, a kingdom. I love in Luke's gospel, the Lord says, I have conferred upon you a kingdom.
Yeah.
He tells the apostles and us in the upper room. And we have to realize that if the children of God, we the baptized, don't fight for that kingdom, there is another kingdom. The kingdom of the fallen one, the kingdom of darkness.
Like, yeah.
And sometimes when I look and I see, evil appearing to triumph, I know that that's his only triumph, because the power of grace and the power of goodness has not been unleashed by the children of God. So we have to very much realize that this kingdom has been entrusted to us. And whether it's strong and vibrant and brings about conversion and transformation, God has entrusted it to us. And if we allow ourselves to become lazy, distracted, ashamed, then the kingdom of darkness will become stronger and will appear to triumph in areas and will wreak havoc and claim souls for, eternal damnation. So there's a lot at stake here. Sometimes, God trusts us so much, we can almost say to him, could you trust us a little less?
Because yes.
This has eternal consequences.
Yeah. Our choices do have eternal consequences. And thy kingdom come, and then you get immediately, thy will be done. So you've got a relationship here where the will of God is obeyed. You can get a little glimpse of the kingdom, God's kingdom, but it also means where God's will is not obeyed, you get a glimpse of the other kingdom.
Yes, very much. And powerfully, the Lord repeats that tenet of the prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane and models for us what it means to truly fight for goodness and salvation and peace with God. And it reminds us that if we're going to try to live this way of life and think that we can avoid the cross or not have suffering, then we're just being foolish. The Lord loves us. He spoke the truth to us. If we seek to follow him, the most excellent way of love, and to fight for his kingdom, there will be suffering. And so that tenet, we see even the Lord himself praying profoundly in the garden as he prepares for his passion.
Yeah, yeah. On the question of God's will, let me ask a question which comes up so regularly whenever I communicate this, whether in talks or in writing to listeners, where I talk about pursuing God's will. The question that comes back all the time is, where do I find God's will? I want to know God's will for my life. Where do I find this?
Yes, and I think there are multiple possible answers to that question in our spiritual patrimony. The one that I would emphasize is Galatians chapter 5, what St. Paul describes as the fruits of God's Spirit. The Lord tells us we know a tree by its fruit, and Paul describes the fruits of living in the Spirit of God: peace, patience, kindness, love, self-control, goodness, generosity, gentleness, faithfulness, modesty, chastity, joy. Like, if we look at the options given to us, then which path will give those gifts, will bear those gifts? That, I think, is one of the clearest helps to discernment and to finding God's will. Again, there are others, but I just point us to Galatians chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
I think Paul is giving us a clear path to discern God's will.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's very good. There's, again, I want to stress this a lot. We're kind of skating through this. This is a great, great book. With, like I said, every page has insight. I want to jump, though, if you don't mind, to forgiveness. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. That, as we forgive. I mean, the connection here. We make a petition to God to forgive us, but we also have this kind of condition. As we forgive those who trespass against us, that's a dynamic within the prayer that we don't see connected to the other petitions. Tell us about that.
Yes, yes, very much so. Of the last four tenets, the four petitions, we see, the petition, give us, forgive us, lead us, deliver us. And to your point now, in terms of forgive us, that condition in that part of the prayer, like I stress that a lot. In the book, I recount a powerful homily. As a college student, I heard Father Michael Scanlon, who is the president of Franciscan University, where I attended, get up, and all he did was look at us, and three times, the three different parts of the chapel simply say, as we, as we,
yeah.
as we. And I remember he sat down, I thought, is Father not feeling well today? what was that about, you know? And honestly, it was only later, walking out of the chapel after Mass, I realized, oh, as we, like, forgive us as we forgive others. Like, yeah. And to realize that if we have an unforgiving heart, and we pray the Lord's Prayer, we just have to realize we're praying judgment upon ourselves. And the Lord in the prayer itself is showing us the importance, the centrality of mercy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, by the way, you were recently named by Pope Francis as a missionary of mercy. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, in fact, just last week, the feast of Peter and Paul, June 29th, my bishop came up and read the decree from Pope Francis. And this was a program that was begun in 2016 with the Jubilee year. A lot of people thought the program was going to end with the Jubilee, but the Holy Fathers continued it. And yes, I was appointed as a missionary of mercy, which just means that in addition to my parish duties and my other priestly duties, that the Holy Father really wants the message of mercy to be brought into the trenches, into the grassroots, and really emphasize, the mercy of God. So I've always tried to teach and stress God's mercy. We spoke at the beginning about my book, Doors of Mercy.
Yeah, I remember
I've always
that.
Tried to do that. And now, so even more so, to look for ways in my preaching and teaching and writing to emphasize God's mercy. And then to make the sacrament of confession even more available, I've asked my parish to share this mandate with me, and have asked parishioners to join me in discerning how can the parish be a better field hospital of mercy, right here in our area. And the parish has really rallied the cause, which I'm delighted to see, and have some really great ideas that we'll have to discern and work through and see what we can do. But I think this appointment is just Pope Francis's emphasis, is, as we saw with Pope Benedict and especially John Paul II, this stress and emphasis on mercy in our world today.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's consistent. To John Paul II's encyclical on the mercy of God. Let me also ask a question related to give us this day our daily bread. Are we just asking to make sure that we have full stomachs at the end of the day?
Right. I always like to joke, because that's the fourth petition, the fourth tenet, is right in the middle. And, of course, it talks about food, so I sometimes joke with people that that's our intermission. it helps me to remember, the fourth, that's the give us our this day our daily bread. And it helps people. But the part of that petition that I think is so intriguing is that most people, again, people who've prayed this since they were able to talk, do not realize what appears to be a redundancy. So give us this day our daily bread. And to your point, Al, which is, the first, this day, is within the context of, our sustenance. What do we need for our bodies and in order to care for ourselves in this world? But the last part of that petition, this daily bread, that word daily, it appears as if the early church created this Greek word. And while it's debated in terms of the best way to translate it, one generally accepted translation is, give us this day our supernatural bread.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it appears that the petition is not simply for the bread of this earth to give us bodily strength, but also give us the bread for eternity. So there's a Eucharistic overture right there in the Lord's Prayer in that fourth petition.
Yeah, Yeah. And we do know that the early church did meet regularly, daily, for worship and Eucharist, the breaking of bread in the book of Acts is the phrase. This is just really such a rich book. I thank you for being with me today. You've done, I think, a marvelous job with the Beatitudes here now with the Lord's Prayer. Do you have another writing project?
I'm hoping to eventually in the future do the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, good, good. Well, thank you, Father. We'll talk again soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, Al.
Father Jeffrey Kirby, Thy Kingdom Come, Living the Lord's Prayer in Everyday Life. Like I said, we just skated over it. It's rich. Every page, there's insight here.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
I tell oftentimes an experience that I had at Divine Child when I was a young priest, 1 year ordained. First time I ever really saw the power of the Blessed Sacrament. And we simply exposed the Blessed Sacrament at the end of Mass one night. I encouraged people. I said, you know what? We've been in the habit of praying over people after Mass. I said, we're not going to do that this week. I'm just going to invite people to come on up and pray if they want to pray. And I put the Blessed Sacrament on the altar. I kneeled down. As I kneeled down, the church is in the sanctuary. The whole church. And as I'm looking at this, and I'm looking at the people there, and I'm looking at Jesus under the appearance of bread there, I saw the Lord standing on the altar, and he's just standing there looking out at all the people. And then at a certain point, he turned towards me, and he just bowed, and he says, don't you see how easy this is? You don't have to do anything. You just have to put me out. You put me out, and I will work.
I'm Dr. Stan Williams. Contemplate the universe with me.
Where does darkness dwell? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness?
What we can see of the cosmos is only one-tenth of the mass needed to explain stable spinning galaxies. Science's answer? Massive amounts of dark matter, or stuff we can't see. But the gravitational force of all that dark matter would cause the universe to shrink and collapse. Except the universe is not collapsing, it's expanding. How is that possible? Science's answer? Dark energy. And just like that, the Earth was saved. And just exactly what is dark matter and dark energy, and where does it come from? We have no idea. But God knows. And one day you will too. At AveMariaRadio.net, under Resources, explore the universe with me. I'm Dr. Stan Williams.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta, thanking you for being with me over the last 2 hours. And, you know, kind of a interesting, we started out today's program taking a look at what's going on in Turkey, where they look as though they're going to turn Hagia Sophia, which was originally a Christian place of worship, a church, they're going to turn it into a mosque. Or back to a mosque. It's been a museum. We talked about COVID-19, went over a number of things happening in France and Germany, and also talked about Black Lives Matter. And then we come back to the Lord's Prayer. And again, remember as we go out into the world, and we try to act as faithful disciples in all of these areas, there's no ability to be faithful as a disciple without praying as the Lord prayed. And the Lord's Prayer is his explicit instruction how we can pray with him as we go about our task in the world. Have a great weekend. Lord willing, be back Monday for another edition of Cresta in the Afternoon.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.